Welcome to Radio at Firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters. Firehouse.com brings you the leaders of the nation's fire, rescue, and EMS services, the top columnists and educators, and today's most important issues, headlines, and comments. Listen right on your desktop or download and listen on the go to Firehouse.com.
Welcome to Radio at Firehouse.com. This is the Apparatus Architects with hosts Tom Shane and Michael Wilbur. The show is dedicated to the apparatus industry. If you have any questions for Mike and Tom, please send us an email to podcast@firehouse.com. Good morning, Mike, and good morning, Tom. Thanks for joining us again this month.
Good morning, Pete.
Good morning, Pete. Thanks very much. We're taping this on going into the Memorial Day weekend, so we would like to recognize all our men and women in service to our country that are protecting us and our freedom. While we think that the firefighting profession and the EMS profession is a rather lofty profession, it certainly is outdone and outshone by the brothers and sisters who are out there, not only in this country, but in virtually all portions of the world to ensure our safety and freedom. And we thank them very much for our service to our country. Our rundown this month, we're going to talk about a brief little review here of the recent incidents and accidents section, and Brother Mike's going to take us through that. We're then going to have a little extended session to talk about what do you need to do if you need a new replacement ladder truck, but you don't have enough money to buy one right now, and we're going to take you through some thoughts on that. Dovetailing with that, it looks like the engine company guys are going to stay on the back step this month, and we're going to then go into a brief review of what Mike and Tom think the best type of aerial device might be for your department, whether you're in the market for a new unit or a used unit. We're going to take you through what we think the advantages and disadvantages of the different types of aerial devices are. We're then going to finish up here with a little promotion of some of the programs that Brother Mike and Tom are going to be involved in at the upcoming Firehouse Expo in Baltimore in July, which commences on the 21st of July on that Tuesday, and with events going through all the way up through and including Sunday the 26th. So we're going to take you through some of the things that are going on there, and we'll do a little wrap-up. So, having said that, Brother Mike, indications are that since our last podcast there, we've been doing just a little bit better, and there are some accidents to talk about, but fortunately not any apparatus-on-apparatus accidents, at least none that I'm aware of, and maybe the severity has dropped down a little bit here in the last month. What do you got for us?
Yes, thanks, Brother Tom. Yeah, as months go, on the whole, obviously we still continue to wreck trucks, but the severity and like you mentioned, fire truck on fire truck accident this month was non-existent, which is a good thing. But we take you first to the state of Florida, where a rescue truck was responding to an emergency call with lights and sirens on. They stopped at an intersection to make sure that it was clear, and a civilian driver drove right into the back of the rescue truck. That's something a little new. In Camden, New Jersey, a squad was responding to a report of a house fire when they collided at an intersection with a police car. And now the police are investigating. And I have to stop a minute with this because it just amuses me. I've never seen firefighters ever get on their fire truck and go drive to the scene of a police shooting, but yet police officers feel compelled to jump into their squad cars and try to drive to the scene of fires with lights and sirens on. And I'm not saying that the police shouldn't show up at a fire and do crowd control and maybe offer some protection, particularly in the inner city where I have the pleasure to work. But with that said, the idea that a cop needs to go lights and sirens to a fire call and then take out the first due unit is just absolutely insane. Just absolutely insane. It just goes beyond pale of you know, what were you thinking when you did this? kind of activity, so that they should try to slow down and yield to fire apparatus going to fires anyway. Any thoughts on that, Brother Tom?
Well, I think in some cases, and again, I'm not affiliated in any fashion myself, anyone in my family, there's no relatives that I have that are, as they would call them, peace officers. I sometimes wonder, Michael, if the events that police get dispatched to, part of it, if you think about it, to me is that in an awful lot of communities, the communications center headquarters, the dispatch center, is under the control of the police in some fashion. You know, while there may be a fire department presence there, the dispatchers typically are civilians, but when you go up and they report through their chain of command, that chain of command ends up on the police side of the ledger, not necessarily the fire department. So there is some semblance there. Second thing is probably there was some logic, and I think it's fairly strong considering the fact, particularly in communities where there's combination staffing or volunteer staffing, that there's a lag time between when the station is alerted and members have to respond from wherever they are to get the rigs out, the fact that the police can, in a lot of cases, can get there first. And that can be a good thing in the township where I live in Western New York. The police do a very fine job, and there's been times that they've been able to, close the front door, windows and stuff so that you wouldn't have a oxygen-fed fire. There have been times legitimately they've gotten there first to ensure that everyone's out of the house, and then they do a pretty good job, and they normally don't block the street. They don't try to beat fire trucks to the intersection. So there may be some logic there. In a locale where you've got career staffing and you would think that there would be equal response times, not anything that Michael and I promote, but I think in a fair number of communities, if you pulled people off to the side, they wouldn't do this necessarily in front of the public or at a press conference, but they would admit there is a fair amount of service rivalry between the peace officers and the firefighters. And some of it is, in a lot of cases, just be particularly the way the economy is, Mike, just building up the stats. You took in the incident. It's a little difference, I guess, one could argue, between taking in the incident and taking out the first two engine. I don't know that that's very admirable. Probably wouldn't want to put that on the incident report. But I think it can be a combination of all of those things. If you think about it, why do we have apparatus on apparatus accidents? Because in a lot of cases, we don't have a protocol for understanding, based on who should be arriving at these intersections under normal conditions, first, second, or third, who should have the right of way, even failing the fact that maybe it's not any kind of stop sign or signal-controlled intersection. Normally, when you see police, my observation, respond to any kind of incident, where the general public sometimes might criticize us for, quote, going too fast in our fire trucks, I would have that same perception of the police in a lot of cases. If it's a personal injury accident or a property damage automobile accident, and if it's not life-threatening, if you're the fourth arriving police car, I don't really understand why you needed to blow everybody off the highway, and I see them do it all the times in locations, I'm sure as you do, blow through a traffic-controlled intersection without even tapping the brakes so they can be the fourth or fifth arriving police car. Don't understand that either, but I guess as you go through and you read these scenarios, hopefully to our listeners, it just heightens the awareness that, if you don't have a good relationship with your local law enforcement agency now, behind the scenes, probably not going to get any better when you just show up at the incident and the police car, as Mike and I have a couple of these that we always throw into programs, the police car blocking the fire hydrant. Probably need to figure that out ahead of time. So what do you got else for us, Mike?
Okay, Tom, we take you now to Ohio. And this is one of two crashes within a month's time that occurred with four-door. They're not medium-duty trucks, but yet they're not pickup trucks. They're like the Ford F-550s, the Chevy, a little bit bigger than pickups, but not quite as big as a medium-duty chassis. And in Ohio, it was at an intersection, and it looked to be like a skid-type brush unit that was on the back of this, and it collided with a car and a pickup truck, two serious injuries in the car, and boy, it looks like the apparatus from the pictures was pretty much a total loss. On to the what I would consider the funny picture of the month, although if you own this truck or you were involved with this incident, it wouldn't be too funny. But in California, an Angels Camp Fire District truck rolled down the driveway of the fire station across Highway 4 and ended up into Angels Creek. And you see this fire truck surrounded by trees with the nose. It was kind of a fairly steep embankment that it went down, and the nose is now resting into this creek. Pictures of that as well. I would say there was some probably significant damage to the unit, not to mention the embarrassment.
What kind of a safety device, Mike, do you think may have potentially, you know, prohibited that little incident from happening?
I'm thinking if they chocked the wheels on the truck, Brother Tom, that they probably didn't have to fissure apparatus out of the creek then. That's what I'm thinking.
Yeah, you feel bad for the people. That's rather embarrassing. They maybe change the name of the fire company from the Angels Camp Fire Company to the Angels Creek Fire Company, and then everybody will have a good laugh, and they'll know why it is. And there's been a number of times I've been out with my hobby taking pictures of apparatus, and when the driver comes out, the first thing he does, even if it's on level ground, is to chock the wheels, and it always puts a little smile on my face to know that at least, you know, in that organization, it's become a routine. You know, we carry the wheel chocks for a reason. They're required to either be supplied on a new unit by the NFPA 1901 standard, or you have to supply them. But in either event, if you don't use them, no matter who supplied them, you can potentially end up like those poor folks. So lesson learned here. If your department doesn't have an SOG on wheel chocks, that's pretty basic. Probably want to figure that out, maybe have a little training session, show people how to proper way to chock the wheels and do it, and just not do it when the chief or the officer or the deputy chief is out, you know, out on inspections. You want to be doing it all of the time.
Yeah, I remember breaking in into the fire service that, boy, when you drove, that was like absolutely ingrained into you that, I mean, immediately, once you put the maxi brake on and went outside of the truck, that you were, first thing, before you did pumps or anything, you put a chock under the wheels. We take you now to Hampshire, Illinois, where there was a serious apparatus crash. One of two pumper trucks at this department owned. They are now without it. A 50-year-old firefighter had to be cut out of the wreckage. He suffered neck and back injuries. There was a 21-year-old on the truck who didn't appear to be hurt too badly, and it seems to me, just reading this, reading between the lines, that he probably had a seatbelt on. But in any event, what was interesting about this is that they were just out training, and that when he went over a hill, as they crested the hill and looked down, there was a pickup truck that was blocking part of the roadway, talking with somebody, kind of catty corner, and the driver of this apparatus went over to the left side of the road and got off in the shoulder, except there was no shoulder, and it kind of sucked the truck down off the road. They hit a tree. Lucky, according to this text, that they did not roll the truck, and the civilian that was in the middle of the roadway was ticketed for illegal parking, and the firefighter that was trapped in the truck had to be extricated. And just for anybody that knows anything about fire truck construction, very similar to what you would have in a school bus. And any of the brother and sister firefighters out there that have done a school bus extrication class, you would know right away that it is extremely difficult. Even with all of our hydraulic rescue tools and our know-how, it's extremely difficult to try to pry somebody out of a school bus or, in this case, a fire truck as well. Many times when we wreck these trucks, and there's significant enough damage, particularly in custom chassis, that it is difficult and time-consuming trying to get you out. Another apparatus accident in the beginning of the month in Pennsylvania, and they say a picture's worth a thousand words, and this was a Ford squad, a C-model Ford, that was on a wet roadway. The operator lost control, went over a guardrail, and the truck is basically on this very, very steep incline, but did not roll over. And I would say that if you gave the driver, if you took and opened the window and threw the driver a can of Coke, that would have been enough to actually make him flip over. I mean, it's as close as you can come to flipping a truck over without actually not doing it. Pictures on the website of that as well. West Virginia, firefighters critical following ejection from apparatus while responding to a crash, an MVA, a motor vehicle accident, or if you're out on the West Coast, the TC, a traffic collision. Around noon today in heavy rain conditions, they were involved in a very serious crash. Initial reports are that the firefighter driving lost control of the rig and ended up in a median. Three out of the four firefighters were seriously injured, with at least two of them being ejected from the overturned apparatus, with at least one suffering a very serious head injury. The firefighters were responding to this MVA in this pickup-sized apparatus. Again, this is the second one of the month, not necessarily a medium-duty commercial truck, but not necessarily a pickup either, kind of one of those in-between F-550, again, chassis trucks. Lost control when the apparatus hydroplaned and went sideways, and then once it got off the water and hit terra firma, it started to roll. And then the crash that they were going to, the initial motor vehicle crash or the traffic collision, there ended up being no injuries. So again, once again, we became the greatest life risk and not the people that we were going to try to help. Truly sad. Moving on now to Florida, and this is a heads up to everybody out there. A Florida fire chief is going to be charged in a fatal responding crash. This text came over May 9th, and this is as a result of a collision that occurred in Florida November 21st, where a district fire chief was charged with culpable negligence in a crash that killed a civilian driver. He was driving a sports utility vehicle, the fire chief, when he hit the civilian's car at an intersection. Prosecutors claim that the chief went through a red light without his siren on. And state law in the state of Florida allows emergency vehicles to violate traffic laws, but only when lights and sirens are used and due care is taken to protect life and property. The charges that the chief faces are all first-degree misdemeanors, punishable by up to 1 year in jail. And it's one of those cases, Tom, where just nobody wins when it gets far.
I find that interesting because with the new NFPA standard, while some people are understandably hesitant about, you know, having the event recorder, the black box, so to speak, in that particular case, it could certainly help the department because the black box would be proof positive whether, you know, the unit did have its lights and siren on and would take that standard, excuse right away. You either were or you weren't, and people wouldn't be able to, talk their way out of it. You either were doing it and you were safe or, you know, they've got something on you and you're not safe.
Yeah, that's a good point. That would be the proof in the pudding there. And, again, all that evidence from the back black box is court-worthy and holds up in court. We move on now to Nashville, Tennessee, where a chief car actually struck and killed a civilian. The chief was going around inspecting firehouses, doing just normal chief duties, was not responding. And a female in that city just went out off the curb and went right in front of the chief's car, and she was struck and killed. It's under investigation, but it appears that there will be no charges. Just a horrible, horrible accident for all involved. In Dayton, Ohio, there was a fire truck crash. They hit a car at the intersection. They said they had their lights and sirens on, looked both ways at the stop sign, did not see the car coming toward them. The car was heading down the alley and almost made it entirely through the intersection before the fire truck clipped the back end of the car. Witnesses said the car spun 360 degrees and landed against a utility pole. The female driver climbed out of the window, and they asked her if she was okay, but she was going into hysterics. The district chief there said any time a driver is involved in a preventable accident in his city, they are reprimanded, and that's exactly how the district chief categorized this crash, as one that was completely preventable. It's good to see that chief officers are stepping up and enforcing at least some of the rules. On any emergency run, we stop at red lights. They'll stop to make sure it's clear. In this instance, the trees obstructed the driver's view a little bit, and he claims he did not see the car coming. The woman driving that car was not injured. In another kind of tragic incident that turned out okay, and again, this is one of those that Tom and I, we talk about constantly and preach. When you back up an apparatus, you need to have a spotter or a backer. This occurred up in Canada. There was a five-year-old boy around the fire station, and the operator was backing the truck into the fire station and ran over the little boy. He suffered only some bruising to his feet and legs with no broken bones, almost a miracle. In the state of California, a tender, what we call on the East Coast a tanker, was coming back from a wildfire when it rolled over on I-5 in South Sacramento County. The water tender rolled over several times down an embankment at the overcrossing, coming to rest on its wheel. The driver was the only occupant, and he was able to be self-extricated prior to the arrival of the rest of the FD. He suffered non-life-threatening injuries, but the water tender was a total loss. And again, we have pictures on the website, and I have to tell you that there's no way that the driver of that truck didn't have a seatbelt on. No way he could have been in that cab and survived that without a seatbelt on. It just doesn't seem to me. So he had to be seated and belted in and probably saved his life. In Shiro, Texas, a firefighter was taken to a hospital when his tanker collided with a tractor trailer. More information, hopefully we'll have an update for you next month. That accident just occurred. And finally, to wrap up, Brother Tom, a Toledo firefighter and another person were injured in an emergency medical vehicle when that vehicle and a van crashed at an intersection sometime early this morning. And again, that just occurred, and we'll have more information on that as it becomes available. What else do you have for us this morning, Brother Tom?
Well, we thought it might be appropriate to talk about replacement aerial apparatus for a little bit. I know there's a number of departments that are, you know, throughout the country, and hopefully with some of our listeners that are planning to buy, you know, so in this case we're talking about you own a ladder, an aerial device of some size, some semblance, and you're trying to replace it, and given the economy or given the state of where your particular community is with the funding stream, you do not have enough money to afford to buy a new one. If you think about all the things we spend money on a fire service outside of salaries, in terms of capital expenditures, you know, short of building a new fire station that can go upwards of several million dollars, you know, if you're looking to buy an aerial device, you know, probably at the low cost entry for a new vehicle of any description, not necessarily one that we would, you know, recommend or say this is what you buy, but you can get into the ladder truck business for probably a little over $500,000 if you buy one of these 75-foot single axle you know, quints, and you can easily go well over $1 million when you're buying a piece of platform apparatus. So it's a significant expense in a lot of communities, particularly those that are served in combination departments or in all-volunteer departments. It could conceivably be the most expensive piece of rolling stock that that community buys, bar none. You know, you don't buy a school bus for $1 million. You don't buy a snowplow, a road grader, any of those other things. Not that they're inexpensive, but there's very few things when you go to your the proverbial city fathers and tell them, yeah, you're looking at a replacement aerial device, and for something along the lines of what you might consider, the opening bell starts at $750,000 and it goes up, and you get a blank stare. That's probably why, because those folks are not used to spending that kind of money for any other, you know, motorized equipment that they have in the community. So that being said, here's some things that Mike and Tom are going to throw out that you can consider. And it's not necessarily that we are wholeheartedly endorsing any of these, but these are things that you might want to consider. The first thing is, if your community historically has bonded for apparatus or paid for it at one lump sum shot out of a capital budget, where they either had a replacement fund where they did put monies away each year, or maybe they pay for it all at one time, you know, it shows up on the Visa Gold card and they're used to paying it off when the bill shows up, you may need to consider alternative financing plans. And that can be difficult. There's not one way of doing it that's right or wrong. They can vary a lot because in some communities, because of local laws, you can't do a lease purchase and you have to work around the legal machinations of your particular community. In the smaller areas, sometimes it's just a matter of pride. Michael and I have done some consulting work for folks where they just historically, the fire district or the community had always paid, the old expression is cash on the barrelhead. When it shows up, there's the price of admission, and they were used to paying for that and not having any debt encumbered. And in many cases, it's a matter of community pride and having to break through that barrier to have folks understand that, you know, if buying a new piece of apparatus is what you have your heart set on and you cannot afford a new one, you need to think about alternatives. You just can't sit there, hold pat, and say, well, we're going to hope the price comes down and we're going to figure this out, because chances are that's not going to happen. So, Mike, any experiences that you have there that you want to pass along on the financing aspect?
Yeah, I'm not sure. You might be able to speak better to this, Tom, but at one point in time, the industry, when money was a little bit freer than it is right now, had some really creative finance options, lease purchase agreements, time payments, again, really some creative financing to make this very expensive equipment somewhat more affordable, where you could pay it over time. Is that still the case? Do you know from your information?
Yeah, Mike, one of the things that happens is if you're going to alternatively fund the apparatus and say that you're going to go out and secure and use a lending institution as a source of funding, and you're going to repay the unit over a period of years. It's no different predominantly than a car loan, all right? But a lending institution is going to charge you interest, obviously, for the cost of doing business with them. But many of these lending institutions then have arrangements that they will pre-fund the apparatus to the builder. Now, what does pre-funding mean, right? Anybody that's buying a new fire truck, no matter who you're buying it from, normally that manufacturer or vendor will offer you a discount, at the very least, if you paid for the chassis, either up front or at some point along the line in the process. In other words, you're not going to wait until the unit is completed. Given the cost of doing business today and the high cost of components on a fire truck, if you take, even let's say for round numbers, an $800,000 aerial device, no matter who makes it, and it doesn't make any difference whether they're talking mid-mount, rear-mount tower, who cares. But on an $800,000 fire truck, all right, the better part of about half of that expense is tied up in materials, in components. Whomever is building your fire truck has to buy the engine, the transmission, the axles, the wheels and tires, the suspension, the fire pump if you're putting one on, and then all of the other raw materials. And if you buy an engine, for example, from Detroit Diesel, and you're the Mike Wilbur, you know, fire apparatus company, you pay for that engine typically within 30 days after it shows up, you know, on your loading dock. You don't wait until 9 months later when the vehicle was done, or 3 months later if you're building a smaller unit. You're on 30-day payment terms. So the manufacturer ends up being your banker, inadvertently or directly, however you want to look at it, because they have to buy all those pieces, parts, to allow them to build the fire truck. And while you can understand if you're buying a mini pumper or a little small, you know, attack vehicle, and there's minimal exposure there, and they can build that thing in, you know, 45 or 60 days, well, you maybe do that. If you're building an aerial device and it takes several months, you know, of cycle time from the time you start cutting metal until it's pushed out the door, and then typically it's another 30 days at least to get it to the dealer to have it prepped, to do tool mounting, put your radios in, have it lettered if it wasn't lettered at the factory, to do delivery and training, and then the manufacturer gets his money. Well, now the manufacturer's had to bankroll all those pieces, parts, maybe in some cases for 4 to 5 months. I'm not saying that's unfair, but that's the way the industry has been, Mike. So if one of the advantages that a community has of looking at, okay, maybe you can't pay for the entire vehicle. If you prepaid a part of it, whether you got involved with a lending institution or not, but if you prepay a portion of the unit and then back it up by having a performance bond, as we've talked about before, your money is secure, and you will see the manufacturer will give you a discount for the fact that you've prepaid for the unit, and they're working off of your funds rather than waiting until the end. So,
yeah, I have some experience with that, Tom. Back in 1991, in my small district where we volunteer, and you know, we have okay funding, nothing, you know, extravagant, but you know, we're not pushed to buying on the cheap either. And there was a situation where, and at that time, money was not at the interest rate, low interest rate level that it is now, but money was at 6% and 7%. And we were designing a rescue pumper, and the manufacturer offered us a $30,000 price break if we could prepay the chassis. And just going back to what you had said, that, you know, the chassis with the engine, the transmission, and all those things, the axles that the manufacturer had to expend money for prior to us paying anything, it tied up a lot of their money. And so by offering us this tremendous discount, it made what would have been a non-affordable apparatus affordable. It was actually that $30,000 was the difference of that manufacturer making the sale or not making the sale, and they came up with some really creative funding for us. And we talked about this before as well, particularly on the commercial side of the house, if even with like a Spartan chassis or an HME, if you are going to do that, and you're going to get a chassis from one of those folks, you need to take ownership of that chassis while the body and the rest of the truck is being assembled. One would only have to look at the debacle in New Lexington, where 18 fire departments had actually given that company money for chassis, only to find out that the company was using that money to operate on. And then when the end did finally come, there was no money, and those vendors like the Navistars, the Freightliners, and the Spartans of the world that had shipped chassis to New Lexington that did not get their money, repoed those chassis, and those 18 fire departments ended up with no monies and no chassis. And they had obviously no bid bonds or no performance bonds as well, and they were kind of left in the lurch. On the upside, I learned not too long ago that the grant program, the Firefighter Grant, Fire Act grant program, actually came to the 18 departments rescued, and they were given grants so that they basically got trucks anyway, which was good news, because they could those departments that were buying those trucks from there were probably some of the least in the country that could ill afford to lose that money, because they probably would have never been able to recoup it or get a new truck for a very long time.
Right. So there's one thing. In other words, you may have to think out of the box. You may have to do, for the fire department to get involved, to do a little investigation beyond the technical aspect of the specification writing, to look at in assisting your community or the people that hold the purse strings, that to help them discover ways that you can, you know, creatively finance the unit, all right, to get it. The second suggestion, and Michael will talk about this a little bit. You could look at, let's assume for the moment that your rig here is a 1980 to 83 model of whatever description you want, and it's just tired. You know, the engine, the transmission, not necessarily worn out, but the aerial device just doesn't fit the bill anymore. Doesn't appear that it would be a candidate to rebuild, and a new piece of apparatus is just beyond anybody's wildest imagination. Even with creative financing, the people just laugh again and say, "Chief, forget it." Well, one of the things you consider is to buy a newer, used piece of apparatus. And in Tom's world, that means something that was built after the 1991 NFPA standard, so it has all of the many safety features. It's got the four-door cab. It's got all of the electrical interlocks. It's got a minimum 250-pound tip load ladder. All right, it's something that is in better condition than what you own. It's newer. You want to ask the people for a current certification on the aerial device to make sure that that's valid. You would want to make sure that it's you're buying a device from somebody that's still in business. No disrespect, but if you know you could go out there, well, this would be a bad example because they went out of business in 91. But well, let's say it was one of the last ones that was done. You know, you find a Han Firespire, stainless steel cab, stainless steel body, and it's got the Han Firespire 106-foot rear mount aerial. May be pristine, one owner, low mileage, you know, only driven, you know, to church on Sunday, the Memorial Day parade. As much as I thought Han built a heck of a rig, if Han's out of business, the Firespire device, there's no way you're going to get parts for that or done cheaply, and that might be an extreme example, but you don't want to be buying a newer used device from somebody that's not currently in business. There's a lot of companies that went out of business in the early 90s. You know, now with the demise of American LaFrance, who had, there was some semblance of ways of getting pieces, parts for duplex chassis, which went out of business in the mid-90s through American LaFrance with, you know, the ramp down of the American LaFrance operation. Where do you get parts if you need a windshield for a duplex D450 cabin chassis? Going to be kind of expensive, so you want to steer away from those things. Mike, what would be a good candidate for a used aerial in your estimation?
Well, certainly, Tom, like you said, one that was built after 1991 that had all those safeties that are now inherent in the trucks. One, obviously, like you said, that the manufacturer was still in business and able to provide service and parts. Obviously, the rig would have to have a four-door enclosed cab, which, again, rigs built after 91 would have to have. One that had all of its testing and certification. If you're going to buy, for instance, a Quint, you want to make sure that the vehicle has not only the current certification, but it's worth money. And this goes back to somebody that has a used truck that wants to sell it. On the open market, it's worth a lot more money that the apparatus is if you have several things. One is not only the current testing certifications for the vehicle, but if you had those certifications going all the way back until the vehicle, from when the vehicle was purchased new. So take, for instance, a Quinn that was purchased by a department in 91. If that Quinn had pump certifications from 91 until present day, had an aerial certification from 91 until present day, had the hose tested, and had the pump or portable ladders tested, that truck would be worth significantly more money than, say, a like-in-kind quality truck that didn't have those certifications and that testing. I think another thing that makes the truck more sellable on the used open market is that if you can provide the new owner with all the maintenance records for the vehicle, where it shows that the truck was well maintained. I wouldn't look at any used truck where the potential seller could not provide me with at least the minimum of these kinds of things, i.e. the maintenance records, all the testing certifications. And then, of course, you just have to look at the overall viability of the vehicle. Again, like you said, if the company's out of business, certainly that's one that we want to stay away from. It's just not a good candidate for purchase. But from what I see out there, there are a lot of good used vehicles, and you can really save a great deal of money. I know of one that's for sale, and you can go to my website, emergencyvehicleresponse.com. It's a 1991 Spartan with an LTI body and an LTI 75-foot aerial with a 1,500-gallon-per-minute pump, 400-gallon water tank. It has a 10 kW own and generator, and the unit only has 13,000 miles on it. It still smells new inside. And as we had just discussed, it has all the maintenance records, all the testing records, and that would be a candidate, obviously one of many that are out there right now, a candidate for a department to jump on. It would be particularly good even for a department that has never owned an aerial device. And Brother Tom and I have talked about this often. We go out on consulting jobs, and what do we buy? We've never had one before. ISO came in and said we need to have some kind of aerial device. What do we do? And a lot of times, to buy a good used vehicle like this and figure out what's going to work and what's not going to work in your community, get the community used to seeing this piece. Get your firefighters used to using it before you swallow hard and go out and spend $1 million on a new truck. Get into the trucking business, the truck company business, and learn how to be a truck company before you go out and expend that kind of money to get into the business full throttle. The good used piece just offers a variety of good options. If you take a used piece out and you scrape the paint or bang the aerial a little bit, a lot better doing it to that as far as the learning curve than to take a brand new unit and bounce a tower bucket off the side of a building and have the city fathers go into the full cardiac arrest as they watch you train with this piece.
Exactly, Mike. So to wrap up this segment here before we take a quick break, the other thing that you can consider doing, so we talked about alternative financing, you know, for a new piece of apparatus. We talked about buying a newer used aerial device. Maybe if you have a device that was built after 1991 and it has a tired body on it, or it's, there's some issues where you're looking to increase the compartmentation, you may want to consider doing a rebuilding project on your existing apparatus using the present chassis and body, or potentially a glider kit. And this is where a lot of people are doing this with platform-type devices that have topped out at $1 million or $1 million plus, all right, where they're going to take, in some cases, just the aerial device and mount it on a brand new cabin chassis with new bodywork, engine, and transmission. Both the Marine Corps and the Army have done some glider kit rebuilds with using Pierce products, where they've used the engine, transmission, in some cases the fire pump, all right, or you could look at using a glider where you're using the engine, transmission, the fire pump, if it happened to be a Quint device, and the aerial device, and putting that into a new cabin chassis, completely 2009 NFPA compliant with new body work, right? So there's...
Well, what would be the cost savings on that, Brother Tom, from a new truck?
It's going to depend depending upon what kind of aerial device you have, but nominally, you're going to be looking at saving anywhere from $200,000 to $400,000. If you're talking about a platform device, you could be looking at you're looking at pricing out a new platform Quint, and this thing is coming in at $1.1 or $1.2 million, you could be looking at saving up to $500,000. You know, doing that. So, some criteria to think about, you know, in helping you evaluate if you have a unit for that, a candidate for that.
Do you have some rules that you want to go by for that? I mean, not every used unit is a candidate for this kind of rehabilitation, is it?
No. I mean, like I said, one of the qualifiers to me in my world would be, it would certainly want to be an aerial device, all right, that the manufacturer is currently in business, all right? You don't necessarily need to go back to the guy that built it originally, although you might want to think about that, at least getting a price from them. But you want to be somebody that the engine, the transmission, the aerial device in particular, if you're talking about doing any kind of rebuilding project, those people are in business, or that the replacement parts are currently available, right? The first question you want to ask yourself is, no matter what you do to the device and how much money you throw at it, right, how long are you going to keep that rebuilt or refurbished unit, all right, considering the degree of upgrade that you're going to do, how long is it going to be before you're going to be in a position to buy a new rig? As an extreme case, if you find you've got a 1995 unit, it's got some nicks and dings, and there's no money in the budget for a new rig, well, if you're just going to say, well, let's do a cosmetic rebuild, let's add a few compartments, maybe, you know, change from halogen or strobe-type lights to LED lights, and you're going to spend, $250,000 on that just to keep the rig for 5 years, that's probably not a wise investment. But if you're talking about doing a glider kit, you've got good components, the aerial device has been tested and is solid, and you can get, you know, a good solid technical quote back from potentially the people that built the device originally, or somebody that you have confidence in, and it comes back within budget, and you know in your heart you could get an additional 10 to 15 years out of it, then probably it's a worthwhile candidate. If you're going to be reusing the existing chassis, you certainly, if you haven't weighed that unit lately, you want to go get scale the unit, front axle, rear axle, then the whole unit, and make sure that the unit is not overloaded with respect to what the axles, tires, and suspension are currently capable of carrying. If the aerial device, if you're even curious about doing this, and for some reason your aerial has not been tested in the last year or two, you want to get a good quality independent testing company, such as Underwriters Labs or somebody in that area, in that vein, to come in and test the aerial and your ground ladders and make sure that you've got the basis, no matter what level of refurb that you're talking about or upgrade, that the device in and of itself is in good shape, or that you know clearly what repairs have to be done going into the program.
Isn't that one of the pitfalls, Brother Tom, of doing a rehab, is that a lot of times departments go in blindly, and the initial quote-unquote price that they receive to get the unit redone at the end of the day is far in excess of what they were originally quoted.
That can happen, and generally that is because of the weakness of the original specification. A lot of people think that rebuilding a unit in terms of the detail and the spec is less intense than buying a new apparatus, and my experience has been it's just the reverse, right? You need to clearly identify what you're going to rebuild on the unit versus what you're going to reuse versus what you're going to throw away and have replaced with a new component. And unless you're very explicit with that and having the vendors come in and look at the unit, bumper to back stuff to identify that, it comes at a great cost savings, and it is a very, very beneficial program. But like a lot of things in life, it doesn't come easily, doesn't come at the snap of your finger. You need to look at and make sure the unit meets the needs of the community. If you're thinking about doing this with an 85-foot rear-mounted tower, but now the community, there's no restrictions in terms of the heights of buildings. There are several buildings in town that already are exceed where you can reach with that device, and you have no other complementary aerial device in the community. If this is, you know, the only one that you've got to work with, you need to, in addition to understanding how long you plan on running the unit, it needs to meet the needs of the community and the department. If it doesn't meet the needs of the community and the department, simply rebuilding it and putting on a new pair of frame rails with a higher horsepower engine doesn't solve your baseline problem. All right. And you, again, want to finish up and make sure that as a result of the independent testing company's inspection report on the aerial device, that the parts that you might need to repair and replace certain components on that are indeed going to be available. You know, again, with the unfortunate demise and relocation of the America La France facilities, I'm personally aware of a couple of folks that have older LTI devices, and not that the parts can't, you know, are unavailable, but right now they're unavailable because America La France is in the process of packing up two plants and relocating everything back down to their facility in South Carolina, and it's difficult to try to run some of these things down. And that might be a momentary bump in the road. It could be has some long-term impact. But again, if there were any number of older people, companies no longer in business. We mentioned Hahn. There was Maxim and Mac that used both America La France and Maxim aerials. There was the venerable Peter Persch Company, and there are still some of those devices out there running around, if not in frontline service and reserve service. If you have one of those units, it doesn't necessarily mean that thing's going to fall over tomorrow. But if you have the thing tested and you need some significant repair parts, you're going to have to pay to get them machined, or in some cases, there's only one or two sources to get those parts, and they get to be very, very expensive. So wrapping up, you can look at, you know, if you can't afford a new apparatus, we can investigate alternative financing plans. You can look at buying a newer used apparatus that meets some of the criteria that we've talked about. You can look at a rebuilding project or a glider kit project on your existing apparatus if it meets certain criteria. And for those listeners out there that might find themselves in this bind, if you have particular questions on that topic that you'd like Mike and I to either answer individually for yourself or answer on the air, you can send them in to podcast@firehouse.com. We're going to take a quick break and be back and finish up. We'll be back in just a minute.
Radio@firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters.
Welcome back to Radio@firehouse.com. This is the Apparatus Architects with hosts Tom Shannon and Michael Wilbur. If you do have any questions for the Apparatus Architects, please send us an email to podcast@firehouse.com. Mike and Tom, thank you, and welcome back.
Thanks, Peter. All right, before we go into the continuing discussion, because I'm actually getting a little green in the gills here that we're spending this whole segment here on ladder trucks, but I guess because we need to have equal time there, Michael, for the ladder company listeners out there. For the benefit of those folks that may be finding their way down to Baltimore to the Firehouse Expo in July, which occurs in the fourth week of July, the third full week of July, commencing on Tuesday the 21st, and going through the parade in the flea market, which wraps up on the 26th. Mike and Tom are going to be involved in a couple of different programs. On Wednesday the 22nd, Mike is going to be talking about driver training exercises with your eyes, heads, hands, and feet. Wow, we're using all four things there, Mike, together with some very fine folks from the Montgomery County, Maryland Fire and Rescue Department, and he'll be doing that Wednesday the 22nd at 8 o'clock in the morning. Mike, we know a lot of you truck guys, man. You're going to have to be a Starbucks duck for that one, 0800. I might have to be in the audience for that one myself, all right? On Thursday, between the hours of 1 p.m. and 4 p.m. For those of you that operate in your department with people that might not be intimate in the knowledge of how we operate in the fire service, there's going to be a three-hour program called A Basic Understanding of the Fire Service for Public and the Elected Officials. And I'll be putting on a brief portion of that program just talking about apparatus and fleet replacement issues, together with some other folks that will be presenting other aspects of how we operate in the fire service. On Friday morning at 10:15, a much more palatable hour for my speaking partner, Mike and Tom are going to be talking about the apparatus industry in 2009 and where are we headed. So if you're looking for some insight as to what's going on here, balancing the impact of our needs in the fire app in the fire service, together with that, how the apparatus industry is responding to them and how that impacts our funding stream, we're going to be talking about that for 90 minutes. On Saturday morning, once again at 8:30, Mike gets to sleep in for another 30 minutes. But, Mike, they did a great job putting you on the program early on. Mike's going to be putting on a program talking about the impact of NFPA 1901, the new tech and the new technology on apparatus driving and operation. So there's a couple of different things we're doing. In addition to we're going to be doing a podcast together with just a fine cast of folks from the apparatus industry that will be taping live at the show with people from four to five different apparatus manufacturers in our, I guess it'll be our third annual like apparatus roundtable with folks, and that's always a great time, and we're going to be taping that early in the morning on one of those days. So there'll be four different opportunities to catch either Mike or Tom or both of us together down at Firehouse Expo in July, and we would encourage any of our listeners or for those people to pass the word. And in addition to having a great time down there, we always like the opportunity to meet some of the folks and to interact with you. So we very much look forward to that particular event. So getting back into our rundown, what's the best type of aerial device for your department? And this can imply and have impact for everyone. You know, whether you're a first-time buyer and you're out there surveying the market and trying to figure out what to buy and what to stay away from, or whether you're replacing that that aged device as we had just talked about in the first segment this month, and saying, you know, well, I got a got an old straight frame ladder. We bought that in the day because we had older bays with a narrow overhead door height, and now we're in a newer station and I got 14-foot doors, and I can buy anything from a 75-foot single axle rear mount to a 125-foot five-section rear mount ladder and everything in between. Mike, we're gonna let you run with this here, but as I had it, well, you could consider straight frame aerials, with few exceptions, have kind of gone away. There are a couple of them. People that still build them because of folks that have low overhead height restrictions, less than a 10-foot door, and in some cases, somewhere between 10 and 11 feet. Not all that common anymore. So if in my world, you got to look at, well, there's maybe, with and without a pump, there's five different kinds of devices you can buy. You could buy a rear mount ladder, a rear mount ladder with the quit in both single and tandem axle configurations, a mid mount tower, or, aerial tower or tower ladder with or without a pump, a rear mount tower, either aerial device or box boom design with or without a pump, and then a TDA. So that pretty much covers everything that's out there in the marketplace. Mike, why don't you just briefly run down some of your thoughts here, and I'll interject or either aggravate you as you throw those out. But what do you see the advantages and disadvantages of those? I guess I'll lead in with this. I've observed, and I think it's fairly common, that in a lot of communities where they had not purchased an aerial device before, folks are very skittish of buying something small and compact. The general fear is, maybe a 75-foot aerial device with a pump on a single axle would work for them, but they certainly feel better in buying a longer device, 100-foot, 104-foot. And when they're putting the fire pump on it, it's almost like, well, it's got to be 1,500, and we ought to make it 2,000 gallons a minute. All our pumpers carry 750 or 1,000 gallons of water. We might run this thing out first, so I know you can buy it with 300 gallons of water, but, boy, 400, 400 or 500 gallons of water makes us feel even better, and we just tend to want to buy the biggest thing that the manufacturer says, time out, we can't put any more on there because you run out of room, you run out of weight, you run out of whatever. Maybe in these economic times, maybe it's because you run out of money, you know, because what you want to do is going to run you $1 million and you only got $800,000. I guess it's, as a side note, it's kind of sad to think about that $800,000 wouldn't buy what you want, but a lot of first-time buyers just tend to overbuy and want to buy the biggest and the best until they either run out of space in a station or, you know, run out of money. Rarely does somebody throw out the yellow flag, you know, the referee's flag comes out and go, time out here, we got a penalty, we can't do this. So having that as a segue, what are your thoughts, Mike?
Well, Tom, thank you. I think many trucks and truck committees operate almost out of fear. We take this specification process, this purchasing process, and we've never done it before. And many times, a lot involved in the process, a lot of parties don't really know what they're doing, and it becomes almost a fearful process. A quick story, when we did some consulting work for a department, and they had spec'd out a rear-mounted 100-foot tower with a 2,000-gallon pump. And as we're driving around, I asked our handler, I said, well, how much water comes out of that hydrant by the Home Depot there? I don't know. I said, well, then how can you spec out a 2,000-gallon pump on this Quint and not know how much water is going to come out of the ground to even be able to feed it? And then, of course, why did they get a 100-foot tower? Well, it was explained to me they got the bucket on the end because most of the firefighters in this particular department were older, and they didn't want to walk up a ladder. And, of course, that's not really a terrific reason just to go spend another $200,000 on a tower. And then, of course, why did they get 100 feet? Well, nobody on that apparatus committee that's going to get their name on the bronze plate that purchased this truck wants to hear in 10 years, well, we took it to that fire and it was short. Or we took it to this fire and it didn't work. Okay, for that once in a lifetime fire, that one oddball where you may have come up a little bit short, so we're just going to buy the biggest that we can, so nobody can come back at us and say, well, you should have done that. And so there's almost this fear surrounding this purchase where we don't want to have our name on the plate and have somebody come back at us later on and say that it was too little or it was too short or the pump wasn't big enough. And so there's just an easy way to deal with that. We'll just overbuy everything. And in a lot of cases, as you well know, adds up to just being a tremendous amount of expense for the unit when you start adding bigger pumps and bigger ladders, and we go from single axles to tandem axles, and there's weight issues, and all of a sudden we're trying to put the proverbial 10 pounds of stuff in a 5-pound bag. Another quick story, there was a department in New England who wanted to trade in their 8 engines and 4 trucks and buy 5 Quints. And, of course, in this particular town, there were career firefighters, and it was basically looked at as, you know, almost a union-breaking type operation until somebody in that union challenged the apparatus vendor to take that unit of like-and-kind quantity and try to drive it around the streets in this small, in this old New England town with narrow streets and tree-lined streets. And it was quickly learned that 80% of the streets that this Quint was expected to go down, it couldn't. And so the purchase was scrapped. And as Tom and I have always said, bigger in a lot of cases is just not necessarily better. Often we get called upon as part of being consultants to go in and do an aerial needs assessment in a particular community. And a lot of times doing this assessment is not only about the community that we happen to be working for, but what's going on in the communities adjacent. And we understand that aerial ladders do some things better than towers do, and tower ladders do some things better than aerials do. So the fire ground should not be limited to just one particular type of vehicle. And so if you are in a department that's looking to do a replacement or even potentially a new purchase, and you have four towers surrounding you, it would make a lot of good sense to me that you should be thinking about just buying an aerial and putting one of the towers on an automatic aid so that at the end of the day you have both different kinds of units showing up at the fire location and you get the best of both worlds. You talked about the differences, Brother Tom, of what actually is out there and available. We know first, as far as towers are concerned, that there are two types of towers. There's an aerial tower, and then there's what we've referred to as a tower ladder. Aerial towers are aerial ladders that basically have buckets affixed to the front of them, and generally they come in sizes of anywhere between 85 and 100, 102, 105 feet, versus a tower ladder, which is basically, to throw out a couple names, like a box beam, like a Supton apparatus or an aerial scope, where it's more of just a boom that has an escape ladder on the top of it rather than having an integral ladder. And so that terminology is important and key. What do you want to buy? Do you want to buy an aerial tower or do you want to buy just a tower ladder? And there can be some big differences. The next is, do you want to buy a rear mount or a mid mount? Well, if you're going to buy a tower ladder, it's going to be a mid mount because tower ladders, there are none that we know of that are made in a rear mounted configuration as of now. As we look to the differences between rear mount versus mid mount, we know for a fact that mid mounted towers have a much better scrub area, and scrub area being defined as that area of the building line that can be touched with the basket of the tower ladder or the aerial tower, or even the aerial for that matter. We know because of the position of the turntable within the chassis, in a mid-mounted tower, that turntable sits lower within the chassis, so it has a less steep angle of departure off the side of the rig. And the other situation to look at there, the other piece of the puzzle is the length of each of the booms or each of the ladder lengths. In the case of a rear-mounted tower, they are generally three sections of ladder that average around 30 to 32 feet to make up the 100-foot rear-mounted ladder. So when you're positioning this unit at a building fire, the unit has to be at least 32 feet off the building line. Well, as you get the apparatus further away from the building, then the side-to-side scrub area is drastically reduced. Versus a mid-mounted tower where you could have up to five sections, and each of those sections could be as little as 18 to 20 feet, so that you could take the mid-mounted tower, you could put the basket right on the ground at about 20 feet off the building line. So again, we've gotten closer to the building by 12 feet, which doesn't sound like much until you start operating side to side and you find that your scrub area is dramatically increased. And it really doesn't matter what manufacturer that you buy a mid-mount versus a rear mount. Mid-mounts are just traditionally have better scrub area on the fire ground. Now, it does matter what manufacturer you buy mid-mounted towers from, because some of those towers have better scrub area by design versus some of the other vendors and what they are manufacturing and selling. But a couple keys to this, and apparatus purchasers, fire departments all over the country make these terrible mistakes. One is to take a mid-mounted tower and try to put a raised roof on a cab. We know from one particular vendor that if you have a flat cab, you can get down to 11 degrees. If you raise the roof on that cab, you can only get down to 17 degrees, depending on how the collision avoidance system for the cab is set up. And so you lose a full 6 degrees. And that doesn't sound like much until you have 100 foot of ladder out there, and then you realize that you've dramatically reduced your scrub area. And the other mistake that customers make, that fire departments make when they put specifications on, is that they take the side of the apparatus and they load it up with cord reels and lights and other things that, again, dramatically cut down the scrub area off the side of the vehicle. And those two, the raised roof cab and taking lights and reels and things and putting them on the side of the apparatus, drastically reduce the scrub area of the total unit, drastically reduces its usability, and those are really self-inflicted by the fire departments that are buying them. You have any thoughts on this, Tom?
No, Mike, the other thing, and just to amplify a little bit on those things, is that you talked about what people do to themselves with the vehicle. Most manufacturers will have demonstrator units. It might not be identical to what you're looking to buy, but something similar. With the exception of it, given the economy, not every builder is running around with a full-blown, 100-foot platform Quint that has a retail price of $1.2 million. People that tend to spend that kind of money want the device just that way. But the two thoughts come to mind. One is that if you are thinking sincerely of changing the style of aerial device that you have in your department, you either want to get the manufacturer that you're thinking of working with or manufacturers to get them to bring that a similar device, at least in wheelbase and length, to get around your community, to set it up and see how it operates. At the very least, you want to go visit some of your neighboring departments, or you may have to jump in the car and travel a couple of hours to go talk to people. If you're thinking about buying a particular style of device, and particularly if you've narrowed it down to style and two or three manufacturers, you want to go talk to people that have operated those devices in their community and get their insights and their feedback. I think, as we've spoken before, most fire departments are not bashful about expressing their opinions over what they bought and how they operate. It's interesting that I've seen, not that I think it's significant enough to be a trend, but I have noted that in some departments that previously had, for example, a 105-foot rear mount tower, and found out that for whatever reasons that didn't work out well, whether it was because of, as Mike alluded to, it was a three-section aerial device and it was difficult to maneuver around town, the front-mounted basket platform didn't work out very well with respect to being able to see in the intersections and to maneuver around, where they've changed up and went from that type of device to a mid-mount tower and bought a 75-foot device because they already had another longer aerial in town or something in a neighboring jurisdiction that complemented what they ran, and they were looking to buy a shorter, smaller, maneuverable device. Now, there's certainly a trend in that with pumpers that people have recognized that, not everybody needs a 10-man raised roof, top mount pumper with a 232-inch wheelbase that carries 1,000 gallons of water, an AB foam system, 1,500 feet of your favorite supply line, a rescue tool and a light tower and everything else in the kitchen sink, because they found out it only does one thing real well, and that's go straight in Monday's Memorial Day parade. And I think you're beginning to see a little bit of that with aerial devices that folks have recognized. But again, unless you become a very educated consumer, when you buy this, if you find, you buy the biggest and the best based on what you can afford, you find out that in a lot of cases you bought too big, and now guess what? Now your community is stuck with it. So the best advice we can give the listeners to wrap up on this subject is to talk to the people who build them. They're obviously have an incentive to sell you whatever they build, and that's understandable. Talk to the people that use them, particularly those that use them and they're a couple years old, because within the last couple of weeks, there's been any number of fire service equipment and apparatus shows. With the upcoming Firehouse Expo, you will see apparatus, and in most cases, it's new or relatively new, and everybody's going to like it because the wax and the sunshine hasn't washed off the vehicle yet. You talk to people that run them or run them a lot and get their input. It will help you become a wiser and more educated consumer to make a good conscious purchasing decision as to what it would work out best for your department. So, Mike, before we wrap up, any parting thoughts on this or anything else that we've talked about so far this month on the Apparatus Architect?
Well, I think one key, Tom, going back to what you just said, is that if you're, first off, you ought to invite two or three different manufacturers into town as part of this discovery process and have them bring a demonstrator unit of like and kind quantity to what you want to purchase. And then we have, as has been well documented, Mike and Tom's Rules of 10. And what that department needs to do is to find 10 places in their town that they feel that this truck is going to really be needed, but may be difficult to position and get into place. And challenge each one of those vendors, those manufacturers, to come into town and bring their demonstrator and go to each of these 10 locations. And there may be a location that none of the trucks will work. Well, at least you know that going in. But you are doing a good evaluation on a potential product. It's fair because everybody has to go to the same places and try to set up in the same situation. And you get a real good feel as to how this apparatus is going to operate if you were to purchase it and as you go through time. I just marvel many cases that you see fire trucks being demonstrated out in the parking lot. Well, I've been to a lot of fires in my career, but I've never been to a parking lot fire yet. You need to make sure that this apparatus, when purchased, is going to operate in a majority of the places within your first due in order for it to be of any use to the community.
Mike, some very good thoughts. And then wrapping up here, for any of our listeners, if you have any questions, in addition to the fact we'd certainly like to meet you and interact and help you out wherever we can at the upcoming Firehouse Expo in Baltimore in July, if you have questions, please send them in to podcasts@firehouse.com. For Mike Wilbur and Tom Shan, until the next time we meet, please stay safe out there, and we look forward to seeing you real soon. Take care.
If you have a comment on this program, drop us a line at radio@firehouse.com. Thanks for listening, and stay tuned to firehouse.com for more broadcasts like these, or visit our website at www.firehouse.com/radio. Welcome to...